to give out, and Starkey has to help him get the barbell back onto the cradle. Starkey points at the shark on his right arm.
You get that after Happy Jack?
Connor sits up, nursing the burn in his muscles, and looks at the tattoo.
It came with the arm.
Actually, says Starkey, I was talking about the arm. The way I figured, if the guy who's so against unwinding has an unwinds arm, it probably wasn't by choice. I'd love to hear how it happened.
Connor laughs, because no one's ever asked the question so blatantly. It's actually a relief to talk about it.
There was this kid, a real tough guy. He tried to kill me once, but couldn't go through with it. Anyway, he was the last kid unwound at Happy Jack. I was supposed to be next, but that's when the clappers blew up the chop shop. I lost my arm and woke up with this one. Trust me, it wasn't my choice.
Starkey takes in the story and nods, not offering any judgment.
Badge of honor, man, he says. Wear it out loud.
Connor tries to get to know every kid who arrives, at least a little bit, so they don't feel like just a number waiting to be caught and unwound. So what does he know about Starkey? He's got personality, and a smile that's a little hard to read. He's got wavy red hair that didn't start that way, as evidenced by dark roots that have grown almost an inch since he arrived a month ago. He's a little short, solid, not scrawny. Stocky, that's the word, like a wrestler. And yet he has a confidence that makes him seem taller. There are also rumors that he killed a juvie cop or two while escaping, but they're only rumors. Connor remembers the day Starkey arrived. Every group of new arrivals has at least one kid who thinks blowing up harvest camps is a good idea. Actually, most of them probably think that, but most kids are too intimidated upon arrival to shout it out. The ones who do turn out to either be problems or overachievers. Starkey, however, has kept a very low profile since his arrival. He's assigned to mess duty as a food server, and in the evenings he goes around performing little magic tricks for anyone who's interested. That makes Connor think back to his own first AWOL night. He was given shelter by a trucker who showed him an arm grafted on at the elbow. It was the arm of an unwind that came with an ability to do card tricks.
You'll have to let me see some of your magic tricks, Starkey, Connor says, and Starkey seems a little surprised.
You know everyone's name here?
Only the ones who make an impression. Here, let's switch, says Connor. I'll spot you.
They switch positions, and Starkey tries to lift the weight, but can barely do two reps.
I think I'll pass.
Starkey sits up, taking a long look at him. Most people can't hold eye contact with Connor. It's either the scars or his legend that are too intimidating for them. Starkey, however, doesn't look away.
Is it true that you risk getting caught to save a stork baby?
Yeah, Connor says. Not one of my brightest moments.
Why'd you do it?
Connor shrugs.
Seemed like a good idea at the time.
He tries to laugh it off, but Starkey's not laughing.
I was a stork baby,
Starkey tells him.
I'm sorry to hear that.
No, it's all good. I just want you to know I respect you for what you did.
Thanks.
Outside, someone calls for Connor in that "my problem is earth-shattering" tone of voice that he hears on a regular basis.
Duty calls. Take it easy, Starkey.
And he leaves, feeling a little bit better than when he came in. But what he doesn't see is what happens after he's gone. Starkey lying back on the bench press, doing 20 reps of that same weight without even breaking a sweat. After the sun sets, Connor calls a meeting of his inner circle, a group of seven that Hayden has dubbed the Holy of Holies, and the name stuck. They meet in Connor's private jet at the north head of the main aisle, rather than the old Air Force One, which still reeks of his meeting with Call Me Joe, the resistance rep. It wasn't Connor's idea to have his own private jet any more than it was his idea to wear blue camo. They were both Trace's suggestions to help solidify Connor's image as the fearless leader.
What the hell kind of army wears blue camouflage anyway?
He griped when Trace first suggested it.
It's for air attacks by jetpack, Trace told him. Never actually attempted, but it works in theory.
The idea was to set Connor apart from everyone else. The Admiral had his uniform, all festooned with war medals. Connor needed something to match his own leadership style, whatever that might be. Although he wasn't too thrilled to be running the place like a boot camp, the Admiral had already set things up as a military dictatorship. It wasn't broke, so Connor didn't try to fix it. It had been suggested that Connor take over the old Air Force One, but that was the Admiral's style, not Connor's. Instead, he settled on a small, sleek corporate jet from the outskirts of the graveyard and had it towed to the north end of the main aisle. Connor occasionally hears kids grumbling about it.
"Look at him living like a king while the rest of us get nothing but a bedroll."
"Nature of the beast," Trace is always quick to remind him. "Respect doesn't come without a little resentment."
Connor knows he's right, but he doesn't have to like it. The Holy of Holies arrive mostly on time for the meeting. Once inside, they swivel side to side in the plush leather chairs, for no other reason than that they can. They enjoy the jet far more than Connor does. 6 out of 7 are present. Risa, who's the graveyard's chief medic, refuses to enter Connor's jet until she can roll in on her own, and a wheelchair ramp just to access Connor's jet seems like an extravagance. Trace, always the first to arrive, is head of security, as well as Connor's strategic advisor. Hayden is master of the comm bomb, running computer and radio communications, monitoring the outside world, police frequencies, and all communication with the Resistance. He also has a radio station for the Holies, with a signal that barely reaches half a mile. He calls it Radio Free Hayden. There's a big bruiser of a girl everyone calls Bam, who is in charge of food services. Her real name is Bambi, but anyone who calls her that ends up being treated by Risa in the infirmary. There's Drake, a rural kid who is the sustainability boss, which is just a fancy term for the guy who runs the farm, or the Green Isle, which was entirely Connor's idea. The food it produces has more than once taken the edge off hunger pangs when ADR food shipments have been too small or non-existent. Next is John, a gum-chewing kid with a restless leg who's in charge of maintenance and waste management. And finally Ashley, who claims to be very person-centered and deals with issues. And since just about every kid being tagged for unwinding has issues, she's probably the busiest of the bunch.
"So what's this about?"
Bam asks.
"Because I got stuff to do."
"First off," Connor tells them, "I met with the ADR dude today. We can expect more of the same."
"More nothing is still nothing,"
Drake says. "You got it. We pretty much known we've been on our own for a while. Now it's official. Deal with it."
"What about supplies and stuff we can't scavenge from other planes?"
asks John, his leg bouncing more fiercely than usual.
"If we can't get cash from the front office to buy it, we'll have to creatively find it."
Creatively finding is Connor's euphemism for stealing. He's had to send kids as far as Phoenix to creatively find things the ADR won't supply. Things like hard-to-find medications and welding torches.
"I just got word that a new jet is being retired here next Tuesday," Hayden tells them. "I'm sure when we got it, we'll find a lot of things we need. Coolant compressors, hydraulic thingamajiggies, and all that other hardcore mechanical blue-collar stuff."
"Is the baggage compartment going to be stuffed full of holies?" someone asks.
"No plane arrives without mystery meat," Hayden says. "No telling how many kids there'll be, though."
"I hope there aren't any coffins this time,"
Ashley says.
"Do you have any idea how many kids had nightmares from that?"
"Oh, please. Coffins are so last month," says Hayden. "This time it's beer kegs."
"The bigger issue," says Connor, "is having an escape plan. We can't rely on the ADR to save us if the juvies decide it's time for fresh parts."
"Why don't we just bail now?"
asks Ashley.
"And find a new place to be."
"It's not that easy to move 700 kids. Doing it would be like sending up a flare to every juvie cop in Arizona. Hayden's team has been doing a pretty good job tracking the threat level, so we'll have at least some warning before a raid. But if we don't have an exit strategy, we're screwed no matter what."
Bam throws a glare at Trace, who never says much at these meetings.
"What does he think?"
"I think you should do whatever Connor tells you to do," Trace says.
Bam snorts.
"Spoken like a true army buff."
"Air Force," says Trace. "You'd be wise to remember that."
The point is, says Connor, coming between them before Ashley can launch into her anger management speech, that we all need to be thinking about how to kick out of here on a moment's notice if we have to. The rest of the meeting deals with the minutiae of management. Connor wonders how the Admiral could stomach conversations about sanitary napkin supply when the threat of harvest camp was a clear and present danger every minute of every day.
It's all about delegation, Trace has said,
which is the real reason why Connor had called this meeting. You can all go, Connor finally tells everyone, except for Bam and John. We still have things to talk about. Everyone files out, and Connor has John wait outside while he talks privately to Bam. Connor knows what he must do. He just doesn't want to do it. Some people take joy in dishing out bad news, but Connor was never like that. He knows what it's like to be pulled up short, to be told that you're useless, that you're better off unwound. Bam stands with arms folded, sweating attitude.
So, what's up?
Tell me about the tainted meatloaf. Bam shrugs like it's nothing.
What's the big deal? The generator to one of the refrigerators blew out. It's fixed now.
How long was the power out?
Don't know.
So you had no clue how long the thing was without power and he still served the food inside?
How was I supposed to know people would get sick? They ate it, so it's their problem.
Connor imagines the punching bag and makes a fist with his right hand. Then he looks at the shark and forces his hand to relax. More than 40 kids were down for over 2 days, and we're lucky it wasn't worse.
Yeah, right. So I won't let it happen again.
Bam says in such a rude tone of voice, Connor can imagine her saying it that same way to her teachers, her parents, the juvies, every authority figure in her life. Connor hates the fact that he's one of those authority figures now. There won't be a next time, Bam. I'm sorry.
You're getting rid of me just because of one stupid screw-up?
No one's getting rid of you, Connor tells her, but you won't be running food service anymore. She burns him a long, hateful glare, then says,
Fine. To hell with you. I don't need this crap.
Thank you, Bam, he says, having no idea what possessed him to thank her. Send John in on your way out. Bam kicks the jet hatch open and storms out. She turns to John, who waits nervously outside, twisted in a full body flinch from her angry exit.
Go on in,
Bam growls at him.
He's firing you.
That night, Connor finds Starkey doing close-up magic for a bunch of holies beneath the recreation jet.
How does he do that?
Kids ask as he makes bracelets disappear from wrists and appear in other people's pockets. When he's done, Connor approaches him.
You're pretty good, but as the guy in charge, I should ask you to tell me how it's done.
Starkey only smiles.
A magician never reveals his secrets, not even to the guy in charge.
Listen, says Connor, cutting to the chase. There's something I want to talk to you about. I've decided to shake things up in the Holy of Holies.
A change for the better, I hope,
Starkey says, gripping his stomach. Connor chuckles because he already knows Starkey sees where this is going, but that's okay. How would you like to be in charge of food?
I love food, Starkey says, and I'm not just saying that.
Do you think you can handle a team of 30 and get food on the tables 3 times a day for everyone else? Starkey waves his hand and makes an egg appear out of thin air, then hands it to Connor. He saw the egg trick a few minutes earlier, but now its relevance makes it even more entertaining.
Great, says Connor. Now conjure up 700 more for breakfast.
And he walks away, chuckling to himself, knowing that Starkey does have what it takes to make things happen and make them happen right. For once, Connor's sure he's made the right decision. 8. Risa. In the early evenings, when the desert begins to cool, Risa plays piano beneath the left wing of Air Force One. She plays pieces that she knows by heart, and pieces from sheet music that have found their way into the graveyard. As for the piano itself, it's a black baby grand Hyundai, which made her laugh when she first saw it. She didn't think Hyundai made pianos. But then, why should that surprise her? Multinationals can make anything they want if people will buy it. She once read that Mercedes-Benz had gotten heavy into artificial hearts before the Unwind Accord made such technology pointless.
The Pulsar Omega,
the advertisement went. take luxury to heart. They invested a fortune in the product, only to lose every penny once unwinding began, and artificial hearts went the way of pagers and CDs. Tonight she plays a forceful yet subtle Chopin sonata. It pours out like a ground fog, echoing within the hollow fuselages where the Holies live. She knows it comforts them. Even those kids who claim to despise classical music have come asking her why she isn't playing when she skipped a night. So she plays for them, but not really, because it's herself that she's playing for. Sometimes she has an audience sitting before her in the dust. Other times, like tonight, it's just her. Sometimes Connor comes. He'll sit beside her, yet somehow be distant, as if afraid to invade her musical space. The times Connor comes are her favorite, but he does not come often enough.
"He's got too much on his mind,"
Hayden has told her, making the excuses that Connor should make for himself.
"He's a man of the people,"
then he added with a smirk.
"Or at least of two people."
Hayden never passes up a chance to throw a verbal barb about Connor's uninvited appendage. It ticks her off because some things are no laughing matter. Sometimes she catches Connor looking at the arm with an expression that is so opaque it frightens her. Like maybe he's going to pull out an axe and chop the thing off right in front of everyone. Even though he also bears a replacement eye, the match is perfect and the source unknown. It holds no power over him. But Roland's arm is different, holding heavy emotional baggage in its powerful grasp.
"Are you wondering if it'll bite you?"
she once asked as he gazed at that shark. Startled, Connor went a little bit red, as if he had been caught doing something he shouldn't. Then he just shrugged it off.
"No, I was just wondering when and why Roland got this stupid tattoo. If I ever come across the person who got that particular brain cell, maybe I'll ask."
Then he walked away from her, ending the conversation. If it weren't for those daily leg massages, Risa would think that Connor has forgotten about her completely. But even those massages aren't the same. They feel perfunctory now, like the only reason he's there is because he made a promise to himself that he would be, not because he truly wants to be. Thinking about Connor makes her miss a chord, the same damn chord she missed at her life-or-death recital that left her on a bus, speeding her off to be unwound. She growls, then takes her fingers off the keys and draws a deep breath. Her music carries, which means her frustration is being broadcast just as clearly as Radio Free Hayden. What bothers her most is that she cares. Risa was always able to take care of herself, both physically and emotionally. At the state home, either you developed several layers of personal armor or you were eaten alive. When had that changed? Was it when she was forced to play music as kids were led into the building beneath her to be unwound? Was it when she made the choice to accept a shattered spine, rather than having it replaced by the healthy spine of an unwind? Or maybe it was before that, when she realized that, against all sense and reason, she had fallen in love with Connor Lassiter. Risa finishes the sonata, because no matter how she's feeling, she cannot leave a piece of music uncompleted. Then, when she's done, she fights the dry, craggy terrain beneath her wheels and rolls toward a certain private jet. 9. Connor. Connor dozes in a chair that's too comfortable to remain fully awake in, but not comfortable enough to be fully asleep. He's jarred alert by a thud against the side of his jet. By the time the second one comes, he realizes it's off to his left. By the time the third one hits, he realizes someone is throwing things at his plane. He looks out of a window, but in the darkness he sees only his own reflection. Another thud. He cups his hands over his eyes, pressing his face against the glass. The first thing he sees are the curved blue streaks reflecting moonlight. A wheelchair. Then he sees Risa hurling another rock, which hits right above the window.
What the hell?
He opens the hatch, hoping she'll stop the barrage. What's wrong? What's happened?
Nothing,
she says.
I was just trying to get your attention.
He chuckles, not yet getting her frame of mind.
There are better ways.
Not lately.
She moves forward and backward a bit in her chair, crushing a dirt clod that had her tilted at a slight angle.
Not gonna invite me in?
You're invited. You're always invited.
Well, then maybe you should have put up a ramp.
And although he knows he's going to regret saying it, he says it anyway. Maybe you should let someone carry you. She rolls a bit closer, but not enough to close the space between them, just enough to make it painfully awkward.
I'm not an idiot. I know what's going on.
Risa might want this talk right now, but Connor is in no mood. After firing Bam and John, he just wants to end this day and find dreamless sleep until whatever fresh hell awaits in the morning. What's going on is that I'm trying to keep us all alive, he says with a little too much irritation in his voice. And I don't see that as a problem.
Yes, you're so busy keeping us alive. Even when you're not busy, you're busy. And when you do actually talk to me, it's all about the ADR and how hard it is for you and the weight of the world on your shoulders.
Oh, for God's sake, Risa, you are not the kind of fragile girl who needs a guy's attention to feel whole. Then the moon comes out from behind a cloud again, and he can see tears glistening on her face.
There's a difference between needing attention and being intentionally ignored.
He opens his mouth to say something, but his brain fails him. He could talk about their daily circulation massages, but she has already pointed out that even then he's mentally checked out.
It's the wheelchair, isn't it?
No, he tells her. It has nothing to do with that.
So you admit there's a reason?
I didn't say that.
What then?
He steps down from the jet. Three steps that separate his world from Risa's. He kneels before her, trying to look into her eyes, but now they're hidden in shadow.
Risa, I care about you as much as I ever did. You know that.
Care about me?
Love you, okay? I love you.
The words don't come easy for Connor. They wouldn't come at all if they weren't true, so that's how he knows they are. He does love her deeply. That's not the problem. And the wheelchair isn't the problem, and neither is his job of running the graveyard.
You don't behave like a boy when he's in love.
Maybe because I'm not a boy, he tells her. I haven't been for a good long time now.
She thinks about that, and quietly says,
Then show me how you feel the way a man does, and make me believe it.
The challenge hangs heavy in the air. For a moment he imagines himself lifting her out of the chair and carrying her into his jet, all the way to his room at the back, and gently laying her down on his bed, being for her the man he claims to be. But Risa will not be carried, under any circumstances, ever. And he wonders if maybe this is not entirely his fault. Maybe she's partially to blame for this invisible rift between them. With no other way to prove his feelings, he reaches forward with his own hand, pushes the hair back from her face, then leans in, giving her a powerful kiss. He puts the whole weight of their relationship and all their built-up frustration into that single, superheroic kiss. It should be enough to say everything he can't, but when he pulls away, he feels her tears on his cheek, and she says,
If you wanted me with you, you would have built a ramp.
Back inside, Connor lies on his bed in the dark, the moonlight painting cold bars of light across his bed. He's angry. Not at Risa, because she's right. It would have been nothing to build a ramp to his jet. He could have done it in half a day. But what if he had? What if Risa really could be with him in every possible way? And what if the shark on his arm truly did have a mind of its own? Roland attacked her. He tried to force himself on her, and she must have been looking at that damned shark when he did it. She said it didn't bother her, but it bothers Connor enough to keep him awake night after night. Because what if when they were alone together, in the heat of that passionate moment they both wanted, what if he lost control? What if that hand held her too tight, tugged her too hard? What if it hit her, and hit her again and again, and wouldn't stop? And how could he ever truly be there with her if all he could think about were all the things that arm had done, and all the things it still might do? Better not to let it happen. Better to make sure she's never that close. So you don't build a ramp. You don't visit her in her jet. And when you do have physical contact, it's out in the open, where it's safe. And when she rolls away from you in tears, you let her go, thinking whatever she wants to think, because that's better than admitting to her that you're too weak to feel safe with your own arm. Then, alone in the dark of a private jet, you smash your fist furiously against a wall until your knuckles are raw and bloody. But you don't care, because even though you can feel the pain, you know they're not your knuckles at all. 10. Starkey. Starkey spends his days working his particular brand of magic, and he knows that the best magic tricks take practice, patience, and very careful misdirection. Undetectable sleight of hand. For more than a month, he has not betrayed his ambitions. To have done so would have made Connor suspicious. Instead, he networked among the holies, studying the alliances, the friendships, and the power structure. And at last, through careful planning, Starkey has inserted himself in the right place at the right time to gain Connor's favor without him ever knowing that it was all part of Starkey's long-term plan. Now he's in the highest echelon of the graveyard, and although it's only food service, it keeps him in direct contact with all 700 kids. He has more power, more access, and begins to do things that previously might be thought of as suspicious, but now come with the territory of being one of the holy of holies. One afternoon, Starkey wanders innocently into the comm bomb, the graveyard's computer and communications center, which Hayden runs. Its radio equipment was initially designed to pull in and decode enemy frequencies, which it still does, although now the enemy is the National Juvenile Authority. At any given time, it's manned by half a dozen holies, who have been hand-picked by Hayden for their computer skills.
"I'm not the tech geek everyone makes me out to be," Hayden tells him. "I'm just very good at taking credit for other people's work. I think I get it from my father. He was uniquely skilled at stomping on fingers as he climbed the corporate ladder."
Hayden studies Starkey for a moment, and Starkey just smiles back.
"Something wrong?"
"No,"
Hayden says.
"I was just wondering if you're thinking of stealing my position. Well, not that I care. I wouldn't mind working food service for a while, but it would help me to know what your intentions are."
"I just want to know how stuff works around here, that's all."
"Oh," says Hayden. "You're one of those..."
Starkey doesn't know what kind of those he's talking about, but he doesn't care as long as Hayden tells him what he wants to know.
"I have an ethnically diverse team here,"
Hayden tells him proudly, going around the room.
"Tad is Japanese, Haley is Umber, Jivan is Indian, and Esme is half Hispanic. I think her other half must be extraterrestrial because she's too damn smart to be all human."
Esme preens proudly for a moment, then gets back to work cracking coded communications.
"We have Nazim, who's Muslim, working side by side with Lisbeth, who's Jewish. And guess what? They're in love."
"Bite me,"
says Nazim. Then Lisbeth punches him just hard enough to make it clear it's true. Hayden points out the various monitoring consoles.
"There's a communications monitoring program running on this one. It can pull keywords out of anything from emails to phone conversations. It can warn us if the juvie cops are up to something major. Kind of an early warning system originally developed to fight terrorism. But isn't it nice to know we can now use it for civilian purposes?"
"So what do we do if it says things are getting dangerous?"
"Damned if I know," Hayden says. "Well, that's Connor's department."
There's a console from which Hayden creates playlists and runs interviews for his radio-free Hayden show.
"You realize that it doesn't broadcast any farther than you can shout,"
Starkey tells him with a smirk.
"Of course not," Hayden says. "If it did, then the juvies could pick it up."
"If no one's listening, then who's it for?"
"First off," says Hayden, "your assumption that no one is listening is incorrect. I estimate I have at least 5 or 6 listeners at any given time."
"Yes," says Tad. "He means us."
"And second,"
Hayden says, not denying it,
"it's preparing me for a career in broadcasting, which I plan to pursue once I turn 17 and get out of this place."
"Not hanging around to help Connor, huh?"
"My loyalty has the half-life of unpasteurized milk,"
Hayden tells him.
"I take a bullet for Connor, and he knows it, but only until I'm 17.
It all seems pretty straightforward until Esme says,
I thought you already were 17.
Hayden shifts his shoulders uncomfortably.
Well, last year didn't count.
Next to Jivan is a printout, a list of names, addresses, and dates. Starkey picks it up.
What's this? Our good man Jeeves here is responsible for getting us a list of all the kids slated for unwinding from here all the way to Phoenix.
These are the kids for your rescue missions?
Not all of them,
Hayden says.
We pick and choose. We can't save everyone, but we do what we can.
He points out the highlighted names, the ones chosen for rescue, and as Starkey looks over the list, he starts to get angry. There's information about each kid, including birth dates, except for the ones who don't have a birth date. Instead, a stork date is listed. None of the storked kids are highlighted.
So you and Connor don't like saving stork kids?
Starkey says, not even attempting to hide the chill in his voice. Hayden looks genuinely perplexed and takes the list to look at it.
I hadn't noticed. Anyway, it's not part of our criteria. We look for only children in dimly lit suburban neighborhoods. It means fewer people to squeal on us and less of a chance of being seen. See, brothers and sisters can't keep their mouths shut, no matter what we threaten them with. I guess mothers who stork babies mostly give them to people who are parents already. Hard to find a storked only child.
Well, says Starkey, maybe we need to change the criteria.
Hayden shrugs like it's nothing, like it doesn't really matter, and it just makes Starkey angrier.
Take it up with Connor,
he says, then goes on with his grand tour of the communications center. But Starkey's not listening anymore. The revelation in the comm bomb gives Starkey a game-changing idea. One by one, he singles out all the storked kids in the graveyard. It's not an easy task, because most storks want to keep their storking a shameful secret. Starkey, however, makes no secret of his own doorstep arrival, and soon the storked kids begin to seek him out, seeing him as their champion. As it turns out, a full fourth of the graveyard population are storks. He keeps that information to himself. The girl named Bam, who at first hated him because he took her place in the Holy of Holies, warms to him quickly because she's a stork as well.
If you want your revenge on Connor, be patient,
he tells her.
It will come.
She reluctantly takes his word for it. One day Starkey catches Connor when he's busy supervising the dismantling of an engine.
Is there a buyer for it, or are they going to put it up for sale?
Starkey asks pleasantly.
They asked for it in the front office, that's all I know.
The engine says Rolls-Royce. I thought they only made cars.
Nope.
Starkey keeps chatting about pointless stuff until he's sure that Connor is irritated at having to divide his attention between the engine and Starkey. That's when Starkey pulls out what he's been hiding up his sleeve.
Listen, I've been thinking. You know I was storked, right? And, well, you know, it's nothing big. But I thought it might be nice to make some special reserve time just for stork kids at the rec jet, just to show them they won't be discriminated against anymore.
Yeah, sure, Connor says, as he stares at the engine, happy to be ending the conversation.
He never even realizes what he's just given away. Starkey calls his little group the Stork Club, and stakes out the hour between 7 and 8 every evening. While everyone's looking somewhere else, a new class distinction rises within the graveyard. The Stork Club is the only minority with special members-only time at the rec jet. It's a taste of privilege that these kids have never had before, and Starkey wants them to gobble it up. He wants them to get used to it. He wants them all to expect it, and to know that Starkey can deliver. Since Starkey runs food services, members of the Stork Club start replacing others in serving positions and dole out larger servings to other storks with a wink. In the Holy of Holies, the only ones who seem wise to these little creeping alliances are Ashley, whose job it is to root out social flare points, and that obnoxious Sherman kid who replaced John as head of waste and sanitation. It turns out Ralphie was easily bribed to look the other way, and as for Ashley, Starkey pretty much has it under control.
What if giving storks special treatment creates resentment in the general population?
Ashley asks him as he supervises dinner one night.
Well,
Starkey tells her with a mildly seductive smile,
the general population can kiss my ass.
It makes Ashley blush just a little bit.
Just try to keep a low profile, okay?
Still beaming charm, he says.
It's what I do best.
And serves her a nice heaping portion, all the while calculating how she might secretly play into his plans.
You're a hard guy to read,
she tells him.
I'd really like to get inside your head.
To which he responds,
the feeling's mutual.
Each night, during the stork hour at the rec jet, Starkey plants tiny seeds of discontent over games of pool and ping-pong. Nothing so blatant as fomenting a revolution, just innocent suggestions to encourage certain directions of thought.
I think Connor's done a good job for a guy who's not all that smart,
he tells them offhandedly. Or,
I really like Connor. He's not much of a leader, but isn't he a great guy?
Starkey never shows any open defiance. That would be counterproductive. It's not about tearing Connor down. It's about rotting out his roots. He won't even suggest that he should be the one taking Connor's place. That suggestion will eventually come from other storks, and all on their own, without any prompting from him. He knows it will happen, because he knows that every storked kid, deep down, dreams of a world where they're not considered second-class citizens. That makes Starkey more than just the leader of a club. It makes him the hope for storked salvation. Part 3. Windows of the Soul. Collected on the Internet, October 2011. Kidney and other organ prices on the global criminal markets are based upon publicly available reports and are quoted in U.S. dollars. The price represents the amount either paid to the seller of the organ or the price paid by the buyer for the organ. Average paid by kidney buyer, $150,000. Average paid to seller of kidney, $5,000. Kidney broker in Yemen, $60,000. Kidney broker in the Philippines, $1,000 to $1,500. Kidney buyer in Israel, $125,000 to $135,000. Kidney buyer in Moldova, $100,000 to $250,000. Kidney buyer in Singapore, $300,000. Kidney buyer in United States, $30,000. Kidney buyer in China, $87,000. Kidney buyer in Saudi Arabia, $16,000. Kidney seller in Bangladesh, $2,500. Kidney seller in China, $15,000. Kidney seller in Egypt, $2,000. Kidney seller in Kenya, $650. Kidney seller in Moldova, $2,500 to $3,000. Kidney seller in Peru, $5,000. Kidney seller in Ukraine, $200,000. Kidney seller in Vietnam, $2,410. Kidney seller in Yemen, $5,000. Kidney seller in the Philippines, $2,000 to $10,000. Liver buyer in China, $21,900. Liver seller in China, $3,660. Courtesy of www.havocscope.com. 11. Smoker. The boy is certain he's going to die. He sprained his ankle falling into the pit, maybe even broke it. Now it's swollen and blue, and has been that way for days. It's bad, but it's not the worst of his problems. The pit is more than 10 feet deep, and even if his ankle were fine, he'd never be able to climb out. For 5 days he's been screaming for help, and now his voice is nothing but a dry rasp. And all because of those stupid cigarettes. It had been weeks since he'd had a smoke. His supplier had been arrested again, and although there were kids at school who bragged about smoking, no one would offer him a cigarette, or even give him the name of a dealer. That's why he came to this part of town, a warehouse district of unused, rotting buildings, many of which were condemned, but no one wanted to waste the money or energy it would take to tear them down. He knew if he was ever going to score himself some smokes again, this was the place to do it. Even if it was just one or two from some skank Nick addict, it would be worth it. That day was the third time he detoured through the warehouse streets on the way home from school, and nothing, no one. It seemed not even the Nick addicts found the warehouse district worthy of their attention. So imagine his surprise when he saw an open door, and cigarette butts strewn on the ground in front of it like they had no better place to be. He stepped into the rotting building. The huge space smelled of evolving mold, and paint chips littered the ground like a fall of leaves. Then he saw it. Way at the back of the warehouse was a mattress. It was dirty, shredded, probably the digs of some homeless dude. Nothing was remarkable about it. What was remarkable was the unopened carton of cigarettes sitting on the mattress. He couldn't believe his luck. He looked around to make sure there was no one there, then hurried to the mattress, and stepping onto it, reached for the cigarette carton. Even before he touched the carton, the mattress fell out beneath his feet and plunged into the pit. Although the mattress had mostly broken his fall, his right ankle hit the ground unprotected. He almost blacked out from the pain, and when his vision cleared, he realized what had happened. He was furious. His initial thought was that this was some sort of practical joke, as if his buddies from school would be looking down at him at any moment, pointing and laughing, calling him an idiot. But he quickly came to understand that this was not a joke at all. This was a trap. But if this was a trap, why had no one come for 5 days? There had been a jug of water and a box of crackers at the bottom of the pit on the day he fell in, along with a ceramic pot to relieve himself in. Whoever set the trap didn't want him to starve, but he did not do well with the rationing. The food and water was gone in 3 days, and now there's nothing left but a lousy carton of cigarettes, which he can't smoke because there aren't any matches. At one point he tried to eat the tobacco right out of the wrapper, figuring it might have some nutritional value, but it only made him dry heave. Now, with day 5 coming to an end, he's convinced no one's coming for him. No one's going to find him until it's too late. Then, just before dark, he hears footsteps crunching the paint chips on the warehouse floor.
Hey!
He tries to yell.
Over here!
His voice is barely a hiss, but it's enough. A face appears, looking down at him.
My God! What are you doing down there? Are you okay?
Help.
Hold tight, says the man.
He goes away and comes back a few moments later with an aluminum ladder, which he lowers into the pit. Although the boy has no strength to even stand, some secret reserve of adrenaline fuels his climb and helps him bear the pain of putting weight on his ruined ankle. In half a minute, he's out of the pit, throwing his arms around the stranger who saved him. The man sits him down.
Here, have something to drink,
he says and hands the boy a water bottle. The boy guzzles it like it's the only water in the world.
How long have you been down there?
5 days.
He gags as he tries to swallow the water, almost throwing it up, but he manages to keep it down. The man kneels to him, shaking his head.
AWOL unwinds are always getting themselves into trouble. You gotta be more careful.
The boy shakes his head.
I'm not an unwind.
The man grins and nods knowingly.
Yeah, that's what they all say. Don't worry, your secret is safe with me.
Then the boy feels a sudden prick on his arm.
Ouch!
He sees a drop of blood on his forearm, which the stranger collects with a small electronic device.
What are you doing?
The man ignores him, looking at the readout of the device. The boy's aunt is a diabetic, and she checks her blood sugar with something like it, but the boy suspects this device has a different purpose, although he's not sure what that purpose is.
Says the man, raising an eyebrow. It looks like you're telling the truth. Your DNA doesn't match any of the kids in the AWOL Unwind database.
Oh, I get it. You're a juvie cop.
He's relieved, because a juvie cop is safe. A juvie cop will take him home to his parents, who must be worried sick.
Well, I was a juvie cop, the man says. But I'm no longer in that line of work.
Then he holds out his hand to shake.
The name's Nelson. And you are?
Bennett. Bennett Garvin.
Only now that he's had some water and some time does he focus enough attention to get a good look at Nelson. He's unshaven, his nails are dirty, and it appears he hasn't been taking good care of himself. But the most startling thing about him are his eyes. There's a strange, disconnected intensity about them that doesn't match the rest of him. In fact, the eyes don't even match each other. Two different shades of blue. It's unnerving.
"Could you call my parents?"
Bennett asks.
"Let them know you found me."
The faint smile never leaves Nelson's face.
"Oh, I don't think that will be happening today."
Bennett doesn't say anything as he struggles to grasp the situation. But having not eaten, and with the water not yet in his system, everything seems a little fuzzy.
"I can't let you go now that you've seen me."
Then Nelson grabs him roughly, squeezing his arm, poking his side, and putting a dirty hand in Bennett's mouth to check his teeth like a horse.
"Aside from that nasty ankle, you're a top-notch specimen. Oh, a little dehydrated, but nothing a few more water bottles won't take care of. And the black market harvesters don't care whether you're an official unwind or not. They pay just the same."
"No!"
Bennett tries to pull free, but he doesn't have the strength.
"Please, don't hurt me."
Nelson laughs.
"Hurt you? I wouldn't think of it. The better your condition, the more you'll be worth to me."
"My parents have money. They'll pay you."
"I don't do ransoms,"
he tells him.
"But I'll tell you what. I like your eyes. They're very expressive. And because I like your eyes, I'll give you a fighting chance."
Nelson points to the entrance.
"If you can get to the front door before I trank you, I'll let you go."
"Hell, I'll even give you a 10-second head start." He hauls Bennett to his feet.
"Ready, set, go."
Bennett does not need a second invitation. He takes off across the expanse of the warehouse, feeling dizzy, feeling like his feet won't move, but somehow he makes them go.
"One."
His ankle throbs, but he ignores it. His lungs ache, but he doesn't care. He knows this is life and death. The pain is only temporary.
"Two."
Paint chips crush beneath his feet like eggshells.
"Three."
Water sloshes in his belly, making it ache even worse, but he doesn't let it slow him down.
"Four."
The door to the warehouse is open wide. The twilight spilling through the door is as glorious as the bright light of a midday sun.
"Five."
A few yards to go. He's almost there.
"Six, seven, eight, nine, 10."
Even before he realizes he's been cheated, the trank dart hits him right in the back of his neck, delivering a full dose directly into his brainstem. His legs buckle beneath him, and suddenly that door that seems so close might as well be a million miles away. His eyes cross, his vision blurs, and he smells musty toxicity as the side of his head hits the ground. He fights to keep conscious, while above him looms the shadow of Nelson, a dark ghost in a fading field of vision. And the moment before he loses consciousness, he hears Nelson say,
"I really do like your eyes. I like them much more than the ones I have now."
12. Nelson. J.T. Nelson knows he'll never get rich selling careless kids to black market harvesters. Even back when his catches were legitimate, there was no real money in it. But then it didn't matter. When he was a juvie cop, he was willing to accept a steady salary, health benefits, and the promise of a pension. He had been more than satisfied with his place in life, maintaining order and bringing AWOLs to justice. But all that changed on the day the Akron AWOL took him out with his own trank gun. Nearly a year later, he still can't get the image of Connor Lassiter out of his mind. That smug, arrogant look on his face as he shot the trank bullet into Nelson's leg. For Nelson, that was a shot heard round the world. From that moment on, his life was a living hell. He was the butt of jokes, not just in his department, but around the nation. He was held up to ridicule as the cop responsible for letting the infamous unwind go. So Connor Lassiter became a legend, and Nelson lost his job and his self-respect. even his wife left him. But he only wallowed for a little while. He was full of anger, but knew how to take anger and mold it into something useful. If the juvenile authority no longer wanted him, he might as well be in business for himself. Black marketeers don't laugh at him for having let Connor Lassiter get away, and they ask no questions. At first it was just AWOLs. They were quick to fall for his various traps, like the stupid kids they are. Then he caught his first runaway, a kid whose DNA didn't show up on the AWOL Unwind database. He thought the black marketeers would turn him away, but they didn't care. As long as the subject was healthy, he got his price. There were even kids like the one he caught today, who were just unlucky. He's happy to take them, too. His conscience doesn't bother him. What bothers him are their eyes. That's what he has the most trouble with, the way they look at him. Those fearful, pleading expressions, always hopeful down to the last second, as if he might have a change of heart. Those eyes plague him in his dreams. They're windows of the soul, aren't they? But in those early days as a parts pirate, when he looked at his own eyes in the mirror, he didn't see what he saw in theirs. His windows showed no such expression of soulfulness, and the more he looked at his own empty eyes, the more jealous he became. He wanted some of that innocence, that desperate hope for himself. So, one day, he went to his black market contact and claimed the eyes of his latest catch as part of his payment. He was only able to negotiate himself a single eye, but at least that was better than nothing. After that first operation, when he looked at himself in the mirror, he would see in that eye a shred of humanity, and for a little while, he'd be high on hope. It would remind him of the idealistic young man he had once been many years before. One problem, however. Now he had one blue eye and one brown. That wouldn't do. So he claimed another. But that eye didn't quite match the first. So he claimed another. And another. And with each operation he felt a sliver of innocence return to him. He knows that someday soon he'll find the eyes that will make him perfect. And then he can finally rest, because by seeing the world through others' eyes, Nelson is bit by bit becoming whole. The black marketeer wears an expensive European suit and drives a Porsche. He looks more like a legitimate businessman than a shady figure who deals in flesh. He doesn't hide the fact that his business has made him rich. Instead, he flaunts his wealth with the entitled disregard of royalty. Nelson envies him his style. He goes by the name Devan, like some sort of fashion designer, and doesn't refer to himself as a black marketer, but as an independent supplier. His offshore harvest camp is hidden and mysterious. Not even Nelson knows where it is, and he suspects its operation has none of the strict regulations of American harvest camps. He meets Nelson in Sarnia, a Canadian town just across the bridge from Port Huron, Michigan. Devan cannot step on American soil. There are numerous warrants out for his arrest. But the Canadians, bless them, have been far more tolerant. Devan takes possession of the boy with a damaged ankle in the back of a car dealership that he uses as his front. As he looks the boy over, he frowns at the swollen ankle and wags a finger at Nelson, all part of his standard ploy to barter Nelson down. The boy, conscious now but still groggy from a heavy dose of tranks, mumbles incoherently, and although Nelson ignores him, Devan pats him gently on the cheek.
"Don't you worry about a thing,"
he tells the boy.
"We are not barbarians."
It's one of the lines he always uses. It conveys no real information to the boy, but somehow comforts him. It's calculated, like everything else about Devan. The boy is taken away, a price is negotiated, and, as is his custom, Devan pays Nelson in cash from a money clip filled with countless bills. Then he claps Nelson on the back jovially. Nelson gets more respect as a parts pirate than he ever did from his superiors as a juvenile enforcement officer.
"I can always count on you to bring me what I need. Not all my associates are so consistent. Now that the juvenile authority is offering rewards for AWOL unwinds, I find fewer come my way.
Goddamn Cap 17 law, Nelson says.
Yes. Let's hope it's not a sign that society is slipping back to its old, less civilized ways.
Not a chance, Nelson tells him. People won't go back there.
He was just a child when the Unwind Accord was passed and the war ended. But it's not the war that sticks in his mind from those days. It's the fear of the Ferals. With the failure of the public school system, the nation was overrun by teenagers out of work, out of school, and with nothing to do even before the war. In fact, that fear triggered the war more than anything else. One side claimed the Ferals were created by the collapse of family values, while the other side claimed the Ferals were a product of rigid beliefs that no longer met the world's needs. Both sides were right. Both sides were wrong. But it didn't matter when people were terrified to go into the streets at night from fear of their own kids.
Unwinding didn't just end the war, Nelson points out to Devan. It ripped out the weeds. Kept them from choking the rest of us out. Fear of the AWOLs will keep both of us in business.
I sincerely hope you're right.
Devan opens his mouth as if to say more, but thinks better of it.
Is there something you're not telling me?
Nothing to trouble yourself with. Just rumors. We'll talk more upon your next visit. And if you could, please keep in mind that I'm experiencing a shortage of girls. Ones with red hair in particular. Also umbers. Either gender. And of course I'll always pay a high price for people of chance.
I'll keep it in mind, says Nelson, already scheming a way of fulfilling Devan's request.
He'd yet to capture a Native American kid, but one of these days, those so-called people of chance would bust and leave Nelson with not just a winning hand, but an entire winning body. As he drives back across the bridge and onto American soil, his spirits are high. If Devan has worries, they're unfounded. Although Nelson has in recent days chosen the life of an outsider, he still feels he has a finger on the pulse of the times. With so much of the civilized world employing the practice of unwinding, how could anyone deny that it is a viable alternative for the troubled, the useless, and the unwanted? Like the ads say,
unwinding isn't just good medicine, it's the right idea.
It was the very rightness of the idea that made Nelson become a juvie cop to begin with. The knowledge that he would leave the world a cleaner, brighter place by dredging the dregs from the street was what propelled him into the police academy. Eventually, though, his ideals were replaced by an abiding hatred for those marked for unwinding. They were all alike, these unwinds, sucking valuable resources from those more deserving and clinging to their pathetic individuality rather than accepting peaceful division. They insisted on living lives no one else felt were worth the effort. As an officer of the law, the rules of conduct held him back. But as a parts pirate, he could take care of business much more effectively. So, as much as he blamed Connor Lassiter for ruining his life, perhaps the boy had done him a favor. Still, it is supremely satisfying to know that the Akron AWOL died an ignoble death at Happy Jack Harvest Camp. It gives Nelson hope that maybe there truly is justice in the universe. 13. Connor. A retired 787 arrives with only 14 holies packed in empty beer barrels in the hold. Connor wonders if someone in the resistance is just getting bored, or if the barrels were really the most inconspicuous way to ship them. The kids all exit the hold cramped and hunched from the ride, and Connor delivers his usual rallying speech, troubled by the diminishing number of kids in each arriving plane. Then, after they've been brought to the IHOP jet for assessment, and to get them ready for life in the graveyard, Connor returns with Trace to the 787. It's the old Boeing Dreamliner, the first one of its kind to arrive at the graveyard. It was once heralded as the salvation of the aviation industry, and it certainly served its purpose. But there's always something newer, faster, and more fuel-efficient ready to take any jet's place.
"She's still impressive," says Trace, as they walk through the passenger compartment, which is already sweltering in the Arizona sun. "A classical beauty."
"You think you could fly this plane if you had to?" Connor